Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Ma Prem Nayana. Nayana met Osho at the age of 18 and took sannyas in 1978. Nayana lives in a farm in Portugal dedicated to natural animal care and offers courses on the use of essential oils and herbs for animals. I'm so happy to have Nayana on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Nayana, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, so to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
Okay, I was 17 years old when I walked into my house and said to my dad, I'm going to hitchhike to India, which naturally enough caused him some concern. So it's okay, I'm not going till September. This was in February. And meanwhile, he had a friend of his went overland to India with his family. That's Sarabi's dad. And how Sarabi got to India, he was my dad's best friend. So my father wrote to him and said, oh my God, Katie, as I was at the time, wants to hitchhike to India. What am I going to do? And his response was, tell her to come and join us in Pune. But she's going to have to fly out because we're going to be coming back before she gets here, if she hitchhikes. And when I heard that and I saw the name Rajneesh Ashram on the letter that he'd written, I just had this huge, yes, this is what I have to do. And much to the disappointment of my friend that I was going to hitchhike with, I said, this is it. I have to go. I have to fly to this place. So I did. By that time, I was 18. I flew out to Pune, to Bombay, made it to Pune, the gateless gates of the ashram, all these weird orange people roaming around. I was like, oh my God, what have I done? But of course, I was taken in. The love and the reception that I received there from the people and meeting, going to discourse with Osho was turned me, let's say. Yeah. So that I kind of randomly wandered up to the ashram. I got there by mistake. I fell in love with Osho pretty much on first sight, although I still had quite some resistance before I took sannyas. Recognized that this was sort of what I had been unconsciously looking for as a rebellious teenager, and that was it, really. There went my life.
Okay, that sounds great. And I'm curious to hear how you overcame the resistances, how that last step happened. So you came there as a rebellious teenager, and the last thing you can imagine for a rebellious teenager is to become a disciple of a guru in India. So what broke that wall?
Well, first of all, the first time I went there in September of 1977, and I spent a month there and I didn't take sannyas. And what was very clear to me at the time was I knew within myself, not on a mental level, but just on a knowing level, that the moment that I took sannyas, my whole life was going to be that. And I wanted to have some adventure before that happened. I wanted to have some experiences of living. I was, you know, straight out of school. So my friend and I went and traveled for a few months around India, went to the Himalayas, went to Goa, did the whole thing. And with the intention of coming back to Pune to take sannyas in, you know, after Christmas or something. But while I was in Goa, I got really ill. I was a little bit ungrounded and flipping out a little bit, so I went back to England instead of going back to Pune. I knew in my heart I'd already committed myself to Osho. I knew that this was where I was going, but somehow the body was still resistant to going there. So I went back to England, and with the intention of coming back to Pune as soon as I was well. Sarabi's parents, who had turned their house into a center at the time, and sometime in April, I believe, maybe before that, sometime in the early year, I was staying out there, and they were having a group with somebody where they used to invite group leaders there. And it suddenly became clear, I need to take sannyas now. I can't wait to go back to Pune. I just have to take sannyas this minute, which I did. there was a mala. They had a mala there. They'd been prepared to give people sannyas, and I grabbed the mala. So that was it. That's me. And then I sent off for a name and spent 2 weeks without a name until it came back. And then I received my name, Marprem Nayana. And that was it. It's what overcame my resistance was that love overcame fear. You know, I think that's how resistance it comes down. The love is there, the fear is there. Because somewhere in yourself, when you are exposed to the emptiness that is an enlightened being, it's scary. So the love had to become strong enough to trust my love to overcome the resistance.
I see. Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so Osho is definitely one big love in your life. And the other big love, or one of the biggest love affairs in your life since childhood, is horses. And like in a movie, whilst you were in the commune with Osho in America, in Oregon, somehow you ended up being in charge of the ranch horses. So how did that happen?
Okay, well, I mean, I was really, really, really lucky, very blessed to be one of the early people to come to the ranch. I was there on the ranch before Osho even got there, when it was really the Wild West. It was a wonderful time for us. And with the ranch came three horses. That was part of the purchase of the ranch, included these three horses who had been old ranch horses. At a certain point, they were, when we first got there, they weren't around anywhere. They were up at the top of the ranch, what we called out in the big pasture. At a certain point, they were brought down, these three horses, and plus the ranch guy, the ranch manager had some horses. And I looked at them and how they were being kept, and I felt like they weren't being really properly cared for. You know, I used to go out there on my lunch breaks and feed them apples and hang out with them, which was what I'd always done since I was a kid. So I went and I told one of the coordinators this, that I thought they weren't being well cared for. And she said, okay, well, why don't you care for them then? That can be your job now. Which for me, of course, was just like, oh my God, the dream come true to be there on the ranch. Osho was already there by then, and with horses. Because I thought that horses would not be back in my life. You know, I always gave once I went to Pune to live, I had given up horses. It was always something I thought I would grow out of. And then it turned out that another of the coordinators thought that somebody else would be a better coordinator, a better horse person, choice for the horses. And it was taken to Osho to ask him who should coordinate the horses. Because in the very early days, he was involved in everything in that way, you know. And he said that I should be the coordinator of the horses because I loved them.
But at this point, the question is, how did Osho know about your love for horses? I mean, have you had any personal contact with him? Have you spoken to him about that?
I have no idea how he knew. I mean, when he was driving around, in the early days when he went out for a drive, there was no formality about it. We ignored it. It's like we carried on with our work. And sometimes, a couple of times, he'd driven past me that's not even true. That was after I'd been given the horses. So I have actually no idea how he knew I loved the horses. Whether it was in the telling of how I'd come, you know, whether it was somebody, one of the coordinators told him or not, I don't know. But that's what was reported to me that he had said. So there's so many mysterious things about Osho and the way he worked. And believe me, it's not the only occurrence where he says something that you go, how did he know that? You know, how did that come to pass? Because who knows? He was mysterious. There was much mystery around his connection with each of us as an individual. Although I didn't have a very personal relationship. I would say I didn't have a personal relationship with Osho. Like, I wasn't one of those people that he would chat to him, or I met him face to face only in darshans and things. So it was a very mysterious thing that he knew each of us as individuals without knowing us personally.
Yeah, this is incredible. It's unbelievable. And it's not the first time I hear that. So it's not accidental. And now, just out of curiosity, now you steal my curiosity. Do you have any other anecdotes of this mysterious kind of knowledge of Osho, of personal things, without you being, in contact with him?
Oh, gosh, it's the sort of thing that makes my brain go fry. But let me think. One of the ones that I can think of off the top of my head is when I first went to Pune, when I went back to Pune the second time, after I already had my name and my mala, and I had my welcome darshan, I asked Osho to talk to me about my name, because I hadn't heard from him, because I'd taken sannyas by mail. And when I was called up to him, I'm not sure this is a relevant story. It's rather long-winded as well, but I'll continue as I've started, as we say. When I was called up to him, they called Anand Nayana instead of Prem Nayana. And then he was telling me about my name as an Anand, which wasn't a big deal for me. And then afterwards, I was called into the office to say, by whoever had called me up, and apologized that they'd called the wrong name. I said, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. I wasn't listening to the words. I wasn't listening to his words. I was listening to his presence. And years later, in Pune 2, I asked him a question in discourse. And one of the things he said to me in the answering of that is, he says, Nayana, you know perfectly well not to listen to my words. So...
It's amazing. It's amazing. Sorry to interrupt, but Osho, first, he had a memory that is totally out of normal people. I mean, his memory was extraordinary. But I think it's a little bit beyond that, because he could remember such small details after years. And how do you explain that?
You just don't explain it. I mean, that's the one of the wonders about Osho. You don't explain it. Who knows? Was it coincidence? Was it? But the way he said it sounded so intentional to me at the time, and it was a very strong moment for me, because you feel that connection, and you feel how deeply he's entered into you.
That's very beautiful. So going back to your love affair with horses, living in nature and in close contact with animals you love, it's good enough. But on top of that, you were in the presence of a living master and a community of seekers building an utopian city. So in this special milieu, what did you learn about horses and yourself that you carry on in your life today?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to say, on a sort of a practical level, for me, the whole ranch experience and the horse experience on the ranch was like a masterclass. It gave me all of the skills I needed for life, you know. And if you think, at the time I was 20, 21, 22, 23. So it was like my university of life, basically. And one of the amazing things that I learned through the horses and being in that milieu was that horses are an incredible way to learn about yourself, about centering, about clarity of action, about true communicating without hiding anything, hiding yourself, being present. It was like, because in Pune 1, I'd done a little bit of martial arts, Aikido and stuff. And one day I was working with one of the horses in a training, one of the youngsters. And I just realized in the Aikido, what you do is you take the energy that comes towards you and you redirect it. And it's all in a space of love. You receive the energy lovingly and you send it on. It's not against. You're not fighting against anything. And I realized that was exactly what I was doing with this horse. I was taking the horse's desire to move and directing it without it becoming a conflict. We became one in that circle of energy. And I realized that actually, by working on yourself in the same way as you do in martial arts, like becoming more centered, more grounded, more body aware, makes you a better horse person and makes you a more aware of yourself and all of your relationships to life. So I developed a way of teaching people and working with horses that was based on body awareness and martial arts.
Wow, that's fascinating. Combining martial arts and horses is really the first time I hear that. It's beautiful. And that's pretty much part of what you're doing now in your present-day life in Portugal. So I take this opportunity to mention that, you live in a farm, a 100-acre farm, with 9 horses, 3 dogs, and 2 cats. And the place is called Over the Edge Farm. and yes. It's dedicated to natural animal care and conscious harvesting of aromatic plants. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I'd love you to talk about your place, the activities you do, and in terms of the things you have learned and how you kind of weave that with meditation. But also, from a practical point of view, I'm curious to know how you run the place. What's your model for the farm to make it sustainable?
Gosh, you know, one of the things that happens living life with Osho as a guider is it all evolves very naturally in a flow. So it's not like I came here with an idea of how we were going to build a community or run it in this way or run it in that way. The guiding principles of how we live here, and that runs through everything we do, is first of all, listening to nature, being guided by nature and what nature wants us to do. So, for instance, in the care of the horses, we give them their species-specific requirements. We give them a life that they would have if they were naturally in the wild as much as possible, plus the benefits of domestication, which is constant supply of food, lots of scratches, lots of love. But when we came here, our intention was to have a place where the horses could live naturally, where we could have people come and share our love, really, but our love in the form of horses. So we have sort of hang on a second, I need to recollect my thoughts. So tell me again the question. I feel like I'm not really answering your question for you.
Well, there are different levels. So one, of course, you know, feel free to talk about, you know, what you do and how you bring your meditation and Osho in your activities. But then I'm also really curious to know about how you run the place in terms of your model. I mean, there are so many people having lands and having Osho communities, and some people, there are Osho communities where they have residents, some people they run it as a business where they have groups, some people they, I don't know, you know, like...
Okay, so I don't really have a model is what I'm trying to say. What we do is, and this is, so people can come and stay here. So we have a place, we have our home. We live in a way that is based on our focus is our own self-awareness and living life in a way that gives back more than it takes, both on a energetic and a physical level. So our farm is not farmed to produce things. We harvest what the land offers, which is aromatic plants and cork. So everything that we do is as much as possible in tune with nature and the universe and what each individual has to share and express. And then we have places here that people can come and stay as paying guests to enjoy that atmosphere, to learn about horses, about aromatic plants, about meditation. Although the meditation that we do is just, it's every day, it's every moment, it's not a separate thing. Although we do, if somebody wants to do an Osho meditation or whatever, then that's, we'll do that. We'll do dynamic or Kundalini, but it's not something we do on a daily basis. It's just if somebody has an interest to explore that avenue more. So how I feel our model is that the land needs, we need an income. We have a beautiful space. We make it available for people to come and stay. And what happens when the person comes here and how they interact very much depends on their interests, what they want to do. It can just be a really relaxing holiday, or it can be more of a, you know, a focused internal retreat type of thing where they stay in their room most of the day. It's a space we share, and the space is both physical, energetic, and heart. So that's kind of the business model is sharing. The exchange is that people give us money to stay here and to feed them.
It's quite unique, and I'm trying to learn from people because, you know, my idea eventually is also to live in nature, but then the point is how do you make money? how do you survive and how do you live? So that's why I'm curious to hear. But what I like about what you just said is it seems to me, at least the perception I get, is that you know, you're not desperate in trying to make it a business and having necessarily people. The risk with this kind of place is that you put yourself in a position where you know, you need money, and then that spoils the whole pleasure of everything else.
Yeah, I mean, there's different angles, because I also have an online business doing essential oils with animals. So that's another part of it. So that's another income stream. It is difficult finding the income stream, but if you have something to offer, one of my little mottos of life is that my life should support me, and I shouldn't support my life. So the way I'm living is something that has value, and I'm happy to share it. I don't need an awful lot of money, so that's not a big deal. You know, we just need enough we're not stocking for the future or trying to get rich. We're just supporting ourselves and the land. And then you get to the place and you look what is available to create income from, and then it just flows. You know, it's all about flowing. It's all about finding where the energy wants to go and not trying to force anything too much. Just kind of seeing, being open to what existence is bringing towards you, and then flowing with that. And sometimes it's scary, you know, you don't have much ground underneath you. That's why we call the place over the edge, because we're always living a little over the edge, a little beyond our comfort zone. But that's also what Osho taught us, you know. We don't want to get comfortable and safe and live a middle class life. We want to be in the position where we're learning about ourselves and are challenged. So then it just happens. It sounds kind of, you know, a bit new agey and stuff, but it's really not. That is how the universe works.
Yeah, no, I think that's very much part of Osho's teaching. On one hand, it's about trusting existence and going with the flow, but on the other hand, it's also not to get too much comfortable and living on the edge, as you say. One other thing that you do in your farm, and I'd love to learn more about that, is regenerative farming. There is a recent book, I don't know if you're aware of it, by a respected American doctor called Mark Hyman, and he wrote a book, I think it's The Food Fix, and he talks a lot about regenerative farming as basically the solution to the environmental crisis and global warming. So what is regenerative farming, and can you tell me more about that?
So regenerative farming is farming that gives back to the land more than you take out of it. So you're not forcing the land to produce for you. You're seeing what it wants to produce and how you can enhance that, let's say. So it looks at what nature wants to do. You know, in nature, you always have layers of, you have the trees, you have the shrubs, you have the small trees, you have the grasses. Everything grows in layers. It doesn't grow in monoculture in one field. Yeah. Everything. So you can replicate that in producing food, and it, then you're giving back everything that comes from the land goes back to the land. So when you prune a tree, it just gets dropped onto the ground to feed the soil again. So then you're reducing you're producing more biomass for the soil, enriching the soil all the time instead of just raping the land, basically. And here, most of our, you know, I say farming, it's not really, I mean, it is farming, but it's not farming as you would recognize. We need to produce grass to feed our horses, and we need to produce an income for ourselves. And so our way of farming is to encourage the wild plants to grow, which everyone around here thinks is absolutely not farming, because that's what we produce essential oils from, hydrosols. So we allow areas, you know, there's areas of the farm where the aromatic plants thrive, and there's areas where the grasses thrive. So instead of trying to make the whole place green grass, which is what beef farmers do, for instance, we allow those areas, we encourage those areas to do what they want to do. And actually, in the end, it enriches the land and produces more and more. And rather than being in a constant cycle of downgrading, you're upgrading the land all the time. And Portugal is one of the most degraded, ancient, old, it's been farmed for so many centuries, so many millennia. So there's a lot of degradation of land. And one of the things we have here is a cork oak forest. And those trees are endangered. They've had a big sickness because of the way that they've been managed for the last 50 years since the Portuguese left the land and started to plow and started to try and basically to take care of the land in a more modern way. And it's been killing the trees. And nobody's, you know, because it's a poor country, they keep doing it. It's the easy way to do it. So we're trying to reverse that here and create a healthy forest system, because forest is our lungs, right? Forest is good. So, regenerative farming means that you are regenerating, not just because modern farming is just about taking out of the soil and forcing. It's very sort of this nail yang. We will make you produce for us. I hate the word production, for instance, because it's like the whole of society is enslaved by needing to produce. And when people look at my farm and say it's not producing, it makes me crazy because I have so much life, busy, creating this incredible environment all of the time. Because that's what nature does. You don't need to. But production is sort of is what's enslaving humanity, if you ask me, that being forced to produce more and more all the time. In an aggressive way, instead of allowing things to grow in their own time. Now you got me going all philosophical.
No, it's beautiful, you know. Ken, there are some philosophical principles here. You know, it's resistance against exploitation of aggressive capitalism, if you like. You can weave it with all of that, but definitely sounds like a very unintrusive way of connecting with nature. And again, I feel like Osho's message is here as well, because I remember that he was very much even against cutting the branches of the trees. He was laughing at it because they will grow again. So why do you want to bother with that?
Everything we do here is just imbued with Osho. It's maybe this is relevant, actually. One time I asked him how to save the world. He was talking about the new man, et cetera, in Pune 2. And one particular discourse really disturbed me, and I said, "I'm just really scared. What can we do? Is it enough just to meditate? What can I do?" And it was a beautiful answer. But one of the things that he said to me, as he said to other people, is if there's one person celebrating, if there's one person living in love, the planet will not be destroyed. And in a way, this place is my expression of that. So it's one person celebrating.
That is so inspirational. Yeah, that's how I see myself. Wonderful. And so I know I'm jumping up and down, but there is one last topic I really want to cover before we finish the interview, and it's Osho in Portugal. Portugal seems like the place to be at the moment. From legislative point of view, I know that the government has introduced some favorable policies for foreigners, including some tax relief incentives, and also a number of spiritual seekers are moving to Portugal. There are some communities popping up. And in terms of Osho, there is an Osho festival happening every year, I think for the past 10 years, and in the summer, and not far from where you live, if I'm not wrong. So what's happening in Portugal? I mean, do you think it's kind of a momentary trend, or there is something deeper that's going on?
Probably both. You know, there's an energy in Portugal. Portugal, why do I love living in Portugal? Is because it's very human. You know, the people are simple and yet genteel, and they take life on a very simple, in a simple way, but not. It's very, you could say it's old fashioned in that way. There's a level of living here that people enjoy the simple. It's very Zorba, without being terribly emotional or. You know, it's not high octane like Spain or Italy. It's quite low speed. They enjoy good food. They love the family. And they take life with a pinch of salt, if you like. It's a very enjoyable environment to have as the background for your life. Where we live, it's one of the wildest, emptiest areas of Europe, which is something that I like. And that's also, I think, what attracts a lot. I mean, there's a lot of alternative stuff. It's not just Osho. There's all sorts of people trying to find a way to live that is outside of the capitalist mainstream. So there's a lightness here. You're right on the ocean. You know, you feel it's a small country, beautiful country. And I think it's the humanity that catches people. It's interesting about Portugal is it's the country that seems until now to have had the least fear of foreigners. It's like, you know, I've traveled all over the world, and pretty much everywhere you go, that you go into a shop and you talk to somebody and you're a foreigner, there's a sense of strangeness, otherness. And in Portugal, I don't encounter that. I encounter people treating you as a fellow human being, not as a stranger, which is beautiful, because that's how also I feel about life. You know, nobody's really a stranger. So is there some sort of spiritual vortex that's attracting people? I don't think so. I think it's just very practical. You know, it's easy, it's cheap, the land, so people can afford to buy it. You know, there's all sorts of practical reasons, and it's spacious, and it gives you space to, if you're respectful and not, you know, not in their face, then the Portuguese are so friendly and helpful and yeah, human, as humans should be.
That's great to hear. I mean, Chetan and I, we kind of left our traditional corporate life, and we're now, I mean, obviously now it's all on hold because of this coronavirus situation, but we were traveling a little bit about Southeast Asia, and we were with the aim of checking out places where potentially we can start our next stage in life, which is more in nature, more meditative, more going in rather than out. So and Portugal has come up, so it's very beautiful what you're saying. It's interesting to hear, and the fact that people don't look at you as a stranger, that's one of the most beautiful thing I get when I'm with sannyasins. I think Osho, back in the 70s, he created this community that was truly international, but at the same time everyone was there going beyond the nationalities, religious background, professional background, and etc., and you just connect as people, and that's what I'm missing in most of the current world. So it's nice that you have that feeling there.
It is nice. I mean, there are quite a few old now sannyasins here. But it's very loose, you know, nobody's in, it's not like we have, and of course Harida and the Nartan do this beautiful Osho festival every year, which is really lovely. It's such a lovely way for people to taste Osho and his meditations and the whole vibe of the community. If you're going to come to Portugal, you should certainly come at a time when you can go to the Osho festival. Hopefully this year it'll happen, who knows. It really gives a taste of Osho.
Do you get involved with the festival?
I don't. I go over and visit old friends and have a day of meditation or whatever, but I'm not involved with it in more than that. Just as a cheerleader, I cheer it on. I love it. I think they do a wonderful job there.
Okay. Yeah, I hope I can make it this year if it happens. Let's see. Okay, so look, we are heading towards the end, and I've got 3 final questions. But before that, is there anything else you would like to add? Anything that we haven't covered?
The only thing that I didn't mention when I was talking about the place and what we do here is that we do have also like 3 or 4 times a year, we do little, I teach a course in essential oils for animals. We have a aromatic week where you can distill with us and things like that. So that's part of what we do as well. It's not... So you can have the individual retreats, or there's also some week-long retreats that could be that people can come and join in. But going back to the model thing, that's part of the model of what we do.
Okay, so people can learn. It's educational experience.
It's educational and meditational, because it's always, you know, it's always part of the thing that happens here is you're learning about yourself. Everything is just an excuse to start to turn in, really, even if you're doing essential oils for animals or whatever it is. Also, people can come and they can do constellation work with the horses. There's all sorts of ways to work with yourself directly with the horses that we offer, which are very, very powerful and fun. We always, always... Very important to us to feed people well. we're living a little bit of here, totally.
That's a very important part.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I've got 3 final questions which I ask all the guests on the show. And the first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Okay, very slow. I usually am brought my tea and toast in bed by my sweetheart, and that's my first meditation of the day, is my cup of tea with my eyes closed. Then I might do a little social media for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, then I get up, and I take the dogs for a walk and do my Qigong routine, or do a little sitting meditation, or it's basically my quiet time to reconnect in with myself in the mornings, and I have some breakfast, and then we feed the horses. And that takes us to we have our first meeting with the horses, usually they show up. So the first part of my day is, I always have a rule. I tell everyone that comes here, if you see me in the first hour of the morning, do not talk to me, because I need that time to reconnect and just to be with myself. So, yeah, so it's about little exercise, little nature, little quiet time. It's beautiful. I love it.
Okay. So the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Okay. So this question, I need some clarification on. When you say, do you mean like as in an Osho meditation, or as in a set meditation, or is there a meditation that I've ever, my most favorite meditation ever, or clarify?
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, you can mention, you know, riding the horse can be a beautiful meditation, but here it's more about the Osho techniques.
Okay, all right. Okay, so my favorite Osho meditation that I have ever done was the 21-day silent retreat. Which is not one of his common everyday meditations, but it is one that he used to give to people in early Pune days, and it's a whole routine, whole technique for it. But basically, you're alone for 21 days doing nothing. That was the most powerful meditation experience I ever had. On a daily day, from his daily meditations, I'd have to say Kundalini, probably. I mean, they're all so powerful in their own way, but the one that I did the most in the early days of sannyas was Kundalini.
I never heard about the 21 day kind of isolation silent retreat, and sounds really powerful, amazing.
We offer to people to do here as well, but it's really there's written instructions for it in the meditation books. It's something he used to do a lot with people in the early days of Punawan. Me and my partner did it in the same place at the same time in separate rooms in the Himalayas some years ago, and it's very powerful.
Okay, so now you really got my attention. You know, I've been thinking of doing a silent retreat, but then it's hard to find it in an Osho place, at least, you know, I'm not aware of many places unless you go to India, which for me is a bit off at the moment for various reasons. And so I might be one of your guests.
You're very welcome. Yeah, it's definitely a good place to do it here.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. So the last question is, you lead the Osho experiment. You are one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2020?
Wow, I'm sorry. I'm just a bit blown away by considering myself as one of the pioneers of this experiment. It's not something you ever think about of yourself, you know. It's just your life. Anyway, ask me the question again, the last bit. I lost it. It's a very powerful question.
Yeah, so what does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today?
Oh, well, it's not like that's a separate thing. I would say that Osho is with me today. Osho is within me today. It's funny because I don't really consider myself a sannyasin, like as in belonging to a group of people. But I very much feel like every Osho imbues everything I do, that there is no separation between Osho outside, Osho inside, Osho. But he's very much, you know, there's so much gratitude, and definitely he guides, this is his work.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time, for your beautiful answers, and for giving us a taste of Osho through your experience, and for sharing with us everything you've learned from Osho. So, yeah, I really look forward to visiting your place and meeting you in person as soon as possible. Yeah, send you lots of love.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great, lovely thing that you're doing, Svaram. It's beautiful. I think it's great to hear people's voices, because for me, Osho's work is the individual, yeah, and each one of us he's touched in different ways, and you know, different but also the same. But his expression comes through each individual in such a beautiful way, and I think it's wonderful to hear everybody's voices. I really love it.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a beautiful feedback, and somehow it really is the spirit of what I'm trying to do, because Osho is no more in the body, but he lives through this sannyasin. So every time I speak with you or you know, just now, what you just said is an expression of Osho for me. So that's amazing. Thank you.
Good. I look forward to your visit.
Absolutely, as soon as possible. Big hug. Bye-bye now.
You too, and love to China.
Thank you for listening to the Lavo Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit lavoshow.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.